My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And my higher power has decided to have a little fun with me this morning because I'm nervous as all get out, and I'm having the shakes the same as I did when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous for my very first meeting. I'd like to start by thanking that power greater than myself, who I don't always understand, who does for me what I cannot do for myself. And that power is God. I'm an only child, native Vermonter, who grew up Irish, Catholic, Irish, Scotch, Italian background. A family that alcohol was not a requirement. They worked hard. But for me, I think in the very beginning, the isms were there. There were three things that took place when I was growing up that I look back now and I realize kind of predetermined a lot of who I was going to be until I got in these rooms. And the first happened when I was in the second grade. And I don't know what I had done. I don't remember. But I can remember standing in front of the classroom and the teacher chastising me and slapping my hand. And there was a little voice inside of me that said, "Don't ever do anything to call attention to yourself." And when the drink really became a major part of my life, that little voice re-echoed again, "Don't ever do anything to call attention to yourself." So I became a closet drinker, an at-home drinker, because if I drank outside with you people, I knew that I would have no control over what happened to myself, and I would call attention to myself. And the second thing was when I was 15. All through my growing up, I was a reader, and I was always looking in books for something, whatever that something was, and never able to find out. I always say, if you don't know the question, you're never going to understand what the answer is. And books were always, it seemed that people could do things that required a great deal out of them, and they got through it, and everything was rosy at the end. But that wasn't the way it was for me, or at least I didn't think that was the way it was for me. And I knew that there was something in my soul that needed filling. And it wasn't coming from books. It wasn't coming from my family. It just wasn't coming from anywhere. So when I was 15, I asked my parents if I could change from the church that I had been raised in and go to another church. And they said, "Yes, you have our blessing, go ahead and do it." So I joined another church, and you know, a lot of things when they're new, they're exciting, and you find contentment in them. And that was what happened when I went to this church. But still, that connection that I was looking for, that something to fill my soul, wasn't there. And then I went away, you know, and it got to be the junior year of high school, and everybody was talking about what they were going to do when they got out of high school and what college they were going to. And I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer when it comes to scholastics. So I decided that I should go to a cooking school. I wanted to go to school because the four other girls that I hung around with, they were all going to colleges, and I thought, well, I do need to go to a college. And cooking school to me would not have what I called flunkable courses, because I draw attention to myself if I took a flunkable course. This was a predetermined thing in my mind. So I went away to school, and that was where I met my future husband. And that third thing that took place was I found out that my future husband's father was a minister. And I said, "Thank you. Now I've got an inside straight. Now I will have the answer to what I'm looking for that's going to fill that hole in my soul." And I loved my father-in-law dearly, but I never got the answer. And, you know, it got to the point I stopped looking for what that thing was to fill that hole in my soul. Back when I was in high school, I remember taking an English lit class, and we were supposed to be doing poetry at one time, and you were to tell what the poem meant to you. And I read it, and I wrote down exactly what I got out of it, the feelings that I had. And the instructor stood at the front of the class, and he said, "No, that is not right. This is what it means." And it told me very clearly that any thoughts, any feelings, any emotions that I had were going to be incorrect, that they were not of any, didn't have any validity. So, you know, I packed in that into my little bag of garbage that was in my head and in my soul and carried it around, and I thought, well, you know, I'm never going to have that space within me fulfilled, and I'm not worth much of anything because what I think just doesn't matter anymore. So I just kept right on unplugging. I thought, well, you know, I'm here in this space and just keep going on. I'll work. I'll do the things that, you know, should be done, and that's all there's going to be to it. So I got married, moved to Florida, had one son, came back to Vermont, had another son. So by the time I was 19, I was married and had two children. And all of a sudden I realized that being married and having two children is not playing with paper dolls. It's, I didn't have a clue. And gradually, all through high school and that, drinking was not a big thing. The only thing that was active with me was all of the isms of this disease, and they were being well fed. And then I picked up that drink. And it started out, you know, very innocently. My parents used to go grocery shopping Saturday morning, and I'd go over, go grocery shopping Saturday morning. We'd have a shot before, you know, I went. Then there would be another time that you'd have a drink, and then another time there'd be a drink. And fifths got to where they weren't enough, and you'd buy a quart, and then it would graduate to a larger size bottle. And I never saw that there was a problem with me being an alcoholic. My husband drank beer, and I never liked beer. Beer always made me have to go to the bathroom a lot. You know, I wanted something that was going to kind of stay with me, filled you up. And I found that, you know, if we did go out, I would case the area. I can understand a robber casing a joint because we would go to a restaurant or something, and the first thing I would do was check out the room to see if there were any women who I thought were very attractive because I had a feeling my husband would kind of veer over to them. I wanted to check out the competition. Secondly, I wanted to know where the door to the bathroom was, and I wanted to be sure that our table would be in an area where I could walk a straight line to the bathroom because I didn't want to stagger. And, you know, by the time you do something like that, you've kind of lost a lot of gaiety or why you've gone out in the first place. A lot of my drinking was monotonous. It was routine. The only funny thing that I can remember happening while I was quite active in my disease was one night my husband and I decided to go out to a bar. And I got very argumentative, very righteous when I drank. And I wanted to go home, and he didn't. And I was always a person who was very afraid of my own shadow, and for me to hitchhike was a biggie. But I decided I was going to hitchhike home this night. So I march my little butt out of the bar, and I cross the highway, and I stick my thumb out, and this car starts to go by. It stops. I hop right in. And the minute I put my fanny on that seat, and this was a few years ago, and you've got to realize it was kind of a smallish town. I put my fanny on the seat, and I realized that the man sitting in the driver's seat is wearing a uniform. It never dawned on me that there was a bubblegum machine on the top of the car that I hopped into. And I'm like, okay, what do you talk about now? I'm trying to think of idle conversation that we can carry on while this man's taking me home. And he took me home, but I wouldn't let him drop me off in front of the house because I didn't want the neighbors to talk. Go figure, you know. The neighbors all knew. They all knew what was going on, I'm sure. I used to like the wintertime because we had storm windows on, and I could holler at the top of my lungs, and it buffered what was being said in the house. And I didn't like summer because, well, you want fresh air to come in, and you have to open the windows, and with screens on, you have to kind of tone it down a bit. But as I said, you know, the drinking was, all I can describe it as like Pavlov's dog in a maze. As long as nobody changed the pattern of anything, I was perfectly all right. But God bless you if you move something, you know, out of my routine. And my drinking was around the clock for a number of years, and I couldn't tell you even to this day how many years that was, because I just don't know. But I'd get up at about 6 in the morning, go downstairs, have a shot. That one obviously wouldn't stay down, so I'd try again. Usually I could do about 3, and maybe the fourth one would stay down. And then to congratulate myself because I got one to stay down, I'd have another. Then I'd get my husband up and make like I hadn't had any and pour him one so that we could start the day together. And in our kitchen, we had what I realized today was a shrine to alcohol, or an altar to alcohol. Right over our kitchen sink was a wooden shelf that had a paper towel holder on the bottom, and the top of it was a little narrow shelf. And there on that altar to alcohol sat 2 shot glasses, mine and my husband's. And underneath the sink was where we kept our bottles of booze. I had my brand and he had his. And at this point they were half gallons. And for 2 people who came together and got married because they dearly loved one another, it had gotten to the point the only meeting of those 2 souls was at this altar of alcohol and having a shot together. And if it was a good day, maybe he'd put his arm around me or I'd put my arm around him and we'd smile at one another. And that was the way it was, day after day after day after day. I'd go to work and I would craftily try to run an errand around 10 o'clock so I could go back home and have another to maintain that level of what I thought was workability. Get out in the afternoon, do the same thing. If I was lucky, I'd remember to cook dinner for my sons and my husband, but I realized today I think there were a lot of days I didn't. It ended up towards the end that my children were raising themselves because their mother was not there. She was there in body, but she was not there as a mother. And then 9 o'clock at night, I thought I was a gal who was tired a lot, and I had to go to bed early. And I realized today that I was just blacking out. I was gone. And don't wake me up for any reason after I've gone to sleep, because it's like waking Mama Bear out of a den in the wintertime. I was not nice. Some nights my husband would wake up and he'd be downstairs and he'd want to come to bed and he'd holler, "Mary! Mary! Come help me to bed." So I'd go downstairs and this was, you know, I would do my wifely duty, chipper as I was, get him to the bottom of the stairs. I'd put his butt to my shoulder and I thought, "You want to go to bed? You're going to bed." And I'd push. And he'd say, "Slow down." I thought, "There is no slowing down now. We're going upstairs." And that's the way it was. You know, I look at my 2 sons, and I so regret the life that they had to put up with 2 parents who were active alcoholics and whose only thought was each other and drink. I heard in these rooms one time someone say the alcoholic theme song. I'm always on my mind. It was the truth. You know, I thought only of myself all the time I was drinking. This just, you know, it kept going on and on and on. And then one year, my husband's mother passed away. These two shot glasses that sat on that lovely little shelf were from a place called South of the Border. They had lovely inscriptions on them, and I thought, you know, they held just the right amount. None of it slobbered out of the sides of your mouth, you know, when you swallowed. All kind of, it was enough to stay right in and give you a good boost as it went down, and that nice warm feeling in your chest, and then boom, you know, the minute it hits your belly. Well, one of those shot glasses got broken, and again, saying as to how I was such a sweet wife, I kept the one that was left, and I found another one and put it on the shelf for my husband, and because I wanted, obviously, to still make sure I was going to have that right amount. When my mother-in-law passed away, we had to go down to Florida to settle things, and the first thing that came to my mind was, obviously, we'll stop at South of the Border and buy another shot glass. You know, thoughts of funeral and all that stuff was purely incidental. The whole time I'm there, you know, I'm thinking, I can't wait until we get to South of the Border so we can buy this other shot glass. And she had left us the car, so we were going to be driving up, and, you know, gosh, this couldn't have been any more perfect. So we drive out to South of the Border, and obviously, I gather some of you remember this place, because when you go in, there's a big guy, Pedro, and you drive right through Pedro's legs, and you're in this land of enchantment. you know, we got there at night. The gift shop was closed, so I thought, okay, you know, first thing the next morning, we will hit this gift shop and buy this shot glass. And I remember, you know, it was etched in my mind of what it looked like. So we got in there the next morning, and I'm looking. You know how drunk you can zero right in on what you're looking for? I don't care how crowded a place might be. And I looked, and I looked, and I looked, and they no longer made the shot glass. And I'll be honest, I felt more grief at that point than I did for my mother-in-law's death. That tells me exactly how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease can be, and what it can lead me to. That any feeling, any compassion, any humanity is out the window, because I liked to drink and I needed to drink. We came back to Vermont, and a short while later, a cousin of mine who I'd had absolutely no contact with for I don't know how many years called and wanted to know if she could have a place to stay. Now, I didn't even allow my children to bring friends home because, well, I didn't want anybody to know. And any other friends that we, and I use the term friend loosely, any other friends we might have had, I certainly wouldn't invite to my home because it meant you had to share. And I didn't share my bottle of booze with my husband, so why in God's name would I share it with somebody else? But this cousin came, and this power that's greater than myself had me say yes, that she could come and stay at our house. And the little catch was that she was married to an active alcoholic, but she was bringing her boyfriend with her. But okay. I wonder why her husband might have been a tad upset. But they came and they stayed, and she said, oh, we'll only stay for 2 weeks. And that was fine. You know, my husband and I could put up with that. At this point, it had, boy, talk about everything being routine. We'd sit in the living room, and when the program was on TV, we would tolerate that until it got to be a commercial, and then we'd make a beeline to the kitchen to have a shot, and then you go back in and you tolerate the rest of the program, and then go back to the kitchen and have, and, you know, that's what life was like. And I kind of thought that, you know, maybe for a couple of weeks, we could finagle around these two other people in our home and still have our routine of drinking. Well, the 2 weeks went by, and 3 weeks went by, and 5 weeks went by, and my husband in the living room, he would sit in his chair, and I'd sit in mine, and these two would sit on the couch just staring at us, maybe watching television occasionally. you kind of run out of excuses as to why you had to go to the kitchen to have the shot. You know, forget 20 questions. I mean, good Lord. And I imagine it was for Garth. I know it definitely was getting on my nerves. It ended up they stayed with us, I think it was 6 months. Dear Abby wrote a column, How to Get Rid of the Unwanted Guest. I thought, boy, this is the answer. Because I didn't have a backbone to go up and approach her and say, don't you think you ought to move? So I cut the column out and I put it on the bed, right on the pillow. Didn't get the hint for diddly. But you know, I understand today that they were there for a very good reason. There was a process that began for my getting into recovery, for my being able to see that I am an alcoholic, that I'm powerless over alcohol. And part of that process was this couple. Because on November 18th of 1984, my husband decided he'd had enough to drink. And this man was a member of the rescue squad. And he knew all of the people to contact in order for my husband to start getting help and to know what properly to do. And I, in my usual way, I was upstairs sound asleep. Out like a light was what I was. And all of a sudden, something woke me up. You know, if you drink around the clock for a number of years, you don't have a hangover. That was one blessing to that. But you also don't have any moments of clarity. But I came to, and I started down the stairs, and when you come down our stairway, you get about halfway down, and I could look right over to where my husband was sitting. And he said, I've asked for help to stop drinking. He said, I can't do it anymore. And a voice came to me just as clear as a bell, and it said, you will not drink again. I didn't know what that meant, and I knew it scared me. Because I'd had so many years of, you know, drinking just be the only thing. It covered up the not feeling like I fit in, the not feeling like I belong, that I used to look at myself and say that the only reason I was put on this earth was so that the rest of you could look at me and know that this was not what you wanted to be. And that's a very sad, lonely way to live. The next morning, I took my husband to United Counseling, and while I was sitting there, you know, I had never acknowledged that alcohol was a problem in my life. Yeah, I could tell you my husband was, but, you know, not me. But a power greater than myself had me open my mouth and say, I have a problem with alcohol. And boy, that opened a life I never, ever imagined would take place. That night I went to my first meeting. And our eldest son, before this, he'd come to Burlington here to go to UVM, and our youngest son had moved out because, you know, he got tired of being the referee when Mom and Dad fought and tired of living the way that he was having to live. So he left home, and he moved in with his girlfriend, whose mother, unbeknownst to us, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night a call was made to our son, and he came home, took all the alcohol out of the house, and he put Mom and Dad to bed. We started going to meetings, and I don't remember what was said at my very first meeting, but I can remember the feeling that was in that room. And I remember afterwards they came up and they said to me, it's going to be all right. And I didn't have a clue what they meant. But I had to just kind of believe that it was going to be all right. They told me to take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. And I saw the slogans on the wall. And I used to work with Cub Scouts. I used to be a den mother. And I saw those slogans and I thought, oh, crap. They're going to ask me what those things mean to me. I know it's coming. You know, the minute I get ready to walk out the room, they're going to say, what does this mean? What does that mean? But that wasn't what it was all about. And I kept going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. And when they said a woman should get a woman sponsor, I thought, maybe you guys, but not me. You know, I didn't trust other women. I did not want to bare my soul to another woman. And my home group is the Dorset group, and when we first came in, they used to have two meetings, a beginner's meeting and then a regular discussion meeting after that, which thank God we've gone back to that same schedule again. And it was one of those beginner's meetings that I heard a woman say, when I walked in these rooms, I didn't like women, I didn't want a woman sponsor, and I didn't trust women. And it took away that uniqueness of me. I knew that there was one other person there that felt the way I did. I heard, you're only as sick as your secrets. I heard, the same person will drink again. And I knew that I had to change. I had to do the things that you people were telling me, that I was not an exception. And I had always suffered from low self-esteem. And I happened to pick up a book one time written by a 14-year-old girl who'd kept a journal, thank God, who had committed suicide. And she said in her journal that low self-esteem and the feelings that she had about herself were nothing more than rumors she was spreading about herself in her own mind that were not validated on the outside. And I thought, my God, this girl died because she could not see, but thank God she gave me a message that all of that garbage I felt about myself was nothing more than that. Nobody on the outside validated any of that. But it was all just up in here in my mind. Books have been a big part of me getting a message. I think my higher power knows that that's the way that I pick it up, and it's really important to me. I don't know if you find it true with your meetings, but I know with ours, and when I first came in, it seemed to be that if they were going to talk about doing the fourth step, you'd go to meetings, and that, for about the next 3 weeks, would be the only thing at a meeting until you got to where you wanted to stick your finger in your throat and throw up and say, okay, I get the message. Well, I remember sitting at a meeting one night, and because I was such a good AA-er, you know, getting into this room, and I wanted to do things better than my husband did, it got to a certain point in the beginning that every time I went to a meeting, they were talking about sponsor, sponsor, sponsor. And I thought, oh, good Lord. So I thought, well, I'll get a sponsor, because I'll get one before my husband, and that'll mean I'm working the program better than he is, right? Doesn't mean I've got to use the sponsor, but at least now when I go, I can raise my hand and say, yep, I've got a sponsor. But I realized that, you know, I needed to use a sponsor, because I heard that what you put into the program is what you're going to get out of the program. So I had to share with another soul what had gone on with me before I came here. And there was a part of me that held back, because I was afraid if those things came out of my mouth, I knew they were true. My disease told me that if I kept him inside, that maybe I could convince myself that a lot of that stuff really was not true. But I had to get it out. In the beginning, and, you know, even to this day, still take people to meetings, still do a coffee commitment. I beg for a group, because those are the things in the very beginning that helped me to feel I was a part of all of you and not a part from all of you. And, you know, I love my life of sobriety today. I kept hearing in here, a God of your own understanding. And it took me way back to when I was 15 years old. And I finally had the answer, that it was a God of my own understanding. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know how to meditate. I didn't think I did. For me today, prayer is a willingness to have myself be open to a connection with a power greater than myself. And I was always so concerned about it being something structured, something very rigid. And I can't describe to you how I feel on the inside. It's just so fulfilled, so full. When I was in high school, I wanted to work as an occupational therapist because I wanted to help people and to work with people. And I was unfortunately told that I wasn't smart enough to do that. So I never tried. And lo and behold, this power that's so much greater than myself, by my admitting that I am an alcoholic and coming into these rooms and to the best of my ability working this program, I can pass it on and hopefully I can help people. My prayers were answered, not in the package that I thought, but my prayers were answered. And I get so much back in return. Greg and I just in February celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary. And, you know, a lot of those years were spent drinking together. And thank God a lot of those years have been spent in sobriety together. And I always believed when I first met him that God brought he and I together for a reason. I fully understand that today. Our life in this program is second to none. In some ways, this is boy, this has been kind of a hard weekend. 3.5 years ago, a young man walked into these rooms, and he was looking to become sober, and he wanted this program. And he asked my husband to sponsor him. And it ended up, we became mom and dad to him. And it was exactly as if he was our third son. He was at our house all the time. He wouldn't make a move unless he called. Sometimes he'd make a move and he'd call. Because he knew that the answer was going to be no, but he figured, you know, true person in anyone in recovery wants to test the waters. And when we came to his first convention, we brought Mark with us. And I mentioned Mark with a lot of love. And I brought Mark's picture with me because we found Mark dead in bed on the 1st of December of this past year. He did die sober. But I wanted Mark to, for his fourth time, to come to this conference, to this convention. I look at Mark's recovery, and he did so much for so many people in the 3.5 years that he was in sobriety, and he taught me an awful, awful lot about compassion, about love for my fellow man and woman. I'm not politically correct, I'm sorry, I'm still of the old school. But I know that you all taught me in here that I have to give it away in order to keep it, that I have to be honest, and I have to carry the message. I don't carry the alcoholic, but I can carry the message. I thank every one of you. I would not have gotten sober without anybody that went before me. I remember the old-timers when I first came in, and the messages that they had, and the kick in the butt when I needed it. You know, not to have a bit of caring and compassion for the person who's first coming in, but also to just point blank say, this is how it is. Do you want to get sober or don't you want to get sober? I can't really think of anything more that I want to say except that I love all of you. I just picked up a book recently. Karen Alexander wrote a book. She used to be a Catholic nun and left because she realized that she was not sure about her belief in God, and she also had an inability to pray. And she's written a book called The Spiral Staircase, The Journey Out of Darkness. And that's what my recovery has been. It's a journey out of darkness. and I am on a spiral staircase. Because the spiral staircase keeps going around and around, and it gives me a full view of what's taking place. And that's exactly what my recovery is. It's going up all the time to a better place. I love all of you, and I thank all of you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12stepTapes.com.